I bought myself some silk pajamas. You know, like the proper Hugh Hefner ones, like, you know, like the button up with the big trousers that I'm gonna like wear in front of. I'm actually wearing them right now. I
I was
bought
gonna
them.
say, I can see the collar, it looks
Yeah, I
nice.
was. You're welcome. I was just like, you know, you're just like, I've always wanted a pair of those. So that's what I got myself for Christmas. And I love any hobby that I can literally sit in them and do it. As in now.
Like this one, it's the perfect
Exactly.
opportunity to wear pajamas. We don't sit here in business suits.
We don't.
We don't sit at boardroom tables.
No, this is like proper PJ time.
It is.
Yeah.
And we've had to usher several cats out of various rooms.
I can hear mine like trying to body slam a door at the moment, and it's
At
like,
me.
please, can you just be quiet? Every now and then, if you hear like a thud and then a really sad meow, that's my cat. That's Edie.
Brilliant.
One of my friends is actually fostering a dog back in Ontario, and it's this beautiful, like, I don't know what it is. She's probably many things, but she now, my friend, posts Instagram updates about this dog, Nelly, the cutest thing I've ever seen. And it's like on the hour, every hour. Oh, Nelly's discovered how these doors work, and Nelly likes head scratches. And I'm just like, please don't get rid of Nelly. Like, could you just adopt her rather than foster? Because these dog updates are what I'm living for.
That is amazing. Oh, that'd be so sad though if she does find another home for it.
I know. I was like, you can't now. I've
No.
committed to these Instagram stories about this dog. I'm sorry.
No.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Murder Friends, the podcast where three friends from three different countries talk about murder. My name's Alana, and I'm Canadian.
I'm Anna, and I'm American.
My name's Hannah, and I'm British.
So sit back and relax. You're among friends, and let's talk murder. Now, I actually, over the Christmas New Year break, received not one, but two copies of My Sister, the Serial Killer that Anna talked about in a previous. I think it was the best of, maybe, best books you were reading that year.
Yeah, your
Yeah.
reviews, your best of the year.
Yeah, so I got two of them, which was quite nice. And like you said, I finished it in like 2 or 3 days. It was such a
It's
like,
so good, isn't it?
yeah, it's such a quick, like, it's really easy to read, and it's just like a really interesting story that I'd not read that sort of perspective before. So yeah, I have to say, I really agree with your book review. And if any, Anna,
Thanks.
you can take my additional
Can I borrow
copy
one
and
of two copies?
yeah, we can have like this little book club.
I get really offended when people don't like the books that I like. So thank you. But some I was
Sorry, I
reading
don't know what that's
like
like about when people don't like the TV shows you like, so whatever.
Oh, well, that must be a terrible feeling for you, Anna.
No, I'm teasing. I'm just
She's
kidding.
such a bully.
I am. I'm such a bully.
And yeah, 'cause my favorite book is The Secret History by Donna Tartt, and I read some reviews on like Goodreads once, and they were people were just slating it, and I got so overwhelmingly angry that I just shut my laptop and I couldn't deal with it. So I'm really glad you enjoyed that book because
That
it's
I
really
feel
good.
like you can people can always find something wrong with everything. Do you know what I
Yeah,
mean?
but like the Secret History, like especially that particular one is a work of goddamn art. And the same with like I went and saw Jojo Rabbit the other day, and I didn't really know much about it, just people were saying it was good. And I went and saw it, and I think it's like the best movie of 2019. And then I went online, like on Rotten Tomatoes, just to see like what other people were saying. And it was all like, this is such a bore, like so and so tried real hard, but this movie sucks. And I was like, y'all don't know what you're talking
What?
about, so why don't you get off the internet and get a better opinion?
It was
Like, go and watch it again.
As we continue on with our review podcast.
If you don't like our opinions.
It's fine as long as it's ours. But did you guys have a good break?
Yeah, I
Okay.
mean, wow, not all at once.
No.
I mean, I was healthy at least. Poor
Wow, that must have been
Hannah
really nice. That
gets
must have been really
the
nice for you.
Christmas illness.
Hit me hard.
It
Yeah,
did.
I was not well. Still not well, which is the best part of it.
Oh, that's rough.
I'm
Especially
a
when
trooper,
you're.
though. I'll carry on.
So, to start off our true crime news, I guess we kind of have to talk about Harvey Weinstein, We all know the name. He's now going into court, so things are finally happening. But what made me laugh so hard is the pictures of him arriving at court. So for people who don't know him, if you don't, I'm happy for you. Unfortunately, you're going to learn about him. But he has appeared at New York Supreme Court for the first day of his rape trial, which is real exciting stuff. The 67-year-old Hollywood producer is facing 5 charges, including rape and sexual assault, which he obviously denies. But now they're finally going to court. He is known as, like, I guess I'd say, like, a big Hollywood figure, you know, like the ultimate Hollywood producer. And you look at pictures of him arriving in court, and he has a little walker, which just killed me. And I think you guys might call it something different. In the picture, it says it's a walking frame. I've only ever heard of it as a walker. And it's got the little tennis balls.
The tennis balls. Yes, it kills me. Yeah, we call it a walker in America, too. Well, yeah. He also looks like he lost, like, a lot of weight.
He looks really ill, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And I think it was Anna Rule shared, like, a link on our Slack where we do all of our, we compile all of our shows, notes and everything. And it came up with this, like, this little picture of him, like, hobbling into court on this little, I can't remember what they call them in the UK, like the walker, the walking thing. And it really reminded me of The Devil Next Door. Do you know when he was just, like,
yes,
faked going into court, went, like, looking all old and frail?
Or
and
the Golden State
like,
Killer.
Gave you that kind of a, yeah, exactly. Like,
yeah,
Golden
he did
State
that
killer.
Too.
Yeah. All three of them. It was like really heavy duty cases. And they all said, oh, but we're just frail old men. Look at us. Look how frail we are with our tennis balls.
Sake. Harvey Weinstein's 67 years old, like you said. It's not like he's a frail old man.
No.
He's younger than my dad.
And yeah, same.
Like, my dad climbs onto the roof to put up the Christmas lights every year.
Wow. Actually, I'm listening to a podcast at the moment. Catch and Release?
Oh, yeah.
It's by Ronan Farrow. It's really good. And it's not finished yet. So maybe we'll review it once, like, it's done. It's very good. But it kind of, he broke the sort of story open with that. He was the one that sort of did it. And he's, like, the son of Mia Farrow and Woody Allen. Obviously he does address the obvious elephant in the room with Woody Allen in it as well, but he goes over like the case a lot, like the evidence or what he discovered so much more. So if you guys, I recommend, it's not done yet. I think they've only done 4 episodes and took a break, but if anybody's interested in learning more, it's very well done, so check it out.
Yeah, that's great.
Cool.
So speaking of another like bag of crap, Robert Durst. He's been in court on trial for the murder of Susan Berman, who was his supposed best friend. Have you ever seen The Jinx? It was about, I don't know how many years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was out. It was like a docuseries.
Yeah, I think I saw it when it did like come out, or it'd been out for a little while. But I don't really remember much about it.
Yeah, there's a few things. So his first wife disappeared under like mysterious circumstances, supposedly. Obviously, he's kind of always been like the, you know, a suspect. And then, so he comes from a really wealthy family, the Durst family. They're, you know, I believe they're like billionaires. Again, I saw The Jinx, but it has been a few years. And he's kind of the black sheep of the family. He was then his neighbor down in New Orleans, I believe, was found in pieces in bags in a river or a lake. Do you remember that? And essentially, he got out of it. He was tried for the murder but was acquitted because he said he did it in self-defense. But then I don't know why. Chopped his body up, yeah, and then threw it in the water. I'm probably missing some details here, but that's from what, you know, I can remember exactly. Then one of his best friends, Susan Berman, for a long, who he had, you know, lived in LA and he used to visit a lot. She was killed, and a note was sent to the police, saying where to find the body. And the note was always really a big thing, and they featured this in the documentary. There were some misspellings on it that were that Durst commonly misspelled, like Beverly, and the word cadaver was misspelled. They called it the cadaver note. And I believe it was that the handwriting also was so close to his handwriting. And so the police received it. And it's always been like, oh, it was obviously him, but they didn't have any evidence to sort of link him exactly to the death. And this was all featured in there. But he's on trial right now. And essentially, Durst's legal team has, they've always repeatedly denied that Durst wrote the note and sort of fought to block handwriting experts to come in and testify. But on the 24th of December, the defense abruptly reversed course on the issue and basically said that he did write it, but he still wasn't responsible for the murder.
That's interesting that they would, after saying the same message for so long, and this case has been going on, like him being involved in like alleged murders and things has been going on for so long, and then to finally change and say, actually, yeah, no, he did write the note. He's still innocent, though, we promise. But yeah, no, yeah, he wrote the note.
I swear.
It makes you think about like what his, like what the defense's team's instructions were, because it was obviously him saying, oh no, I didn't write the note. I didn't write the note. Yeah, I wrote the note.
Yeah.
That was, it's so strange though.
Well, it's pretty obvious it was him. I mean, I just wrote this note and I knew where to find the body, but I didn't do it.
And I didn't do all those other murders that I've been connected to.
Yeah, I haven't done any of those either. And essentially, the thing with the jinx is, actually, I won't say the big spoiler at the end. There's a big thing that happens at the end, and I won't disclose that. But it's a really good, I think it's a very good series. It's HBO, produced by HBO, so those are usually pretty quality. So if you want to learn more about that, check that out. I'm sure you can probably find it like on Apple and stuff. You can rent it.
So for one of our true crime reviews this week, I really wanted to talk to you guys about Detective Trap, one of the new podcasts that I listen to. Have either of you guys listened to it yet?
Yes.
Yes.
Nice. Okay. So this is, I don't know, I've been in sort of a funk lately with these types of podcasts where I'll start them and then I just can't finish it. But Detective Trap is one of those ones where the story is so... It sounds really morbid to say interesting, but it is very interesting. And I think the podcast itself is such a high quality that it's so easy to binge once you get going. So I thought, I wasn't really sure how I wanted to sort of recap this one because there's so much detail. So I've taken some information from the LA Times, who actually produce the podcast. And I'm going to get us up to, I think, maybe the big twist, and then we'll leave it there. Just in case if you do want to listen to it, not the whole thing's gone, but it is such a high-quality podcast. These guys are the ones that do Dirty John and Room 20, which I both really liked. So if you want a good podcast, by all means.
Is it Wondery that do them?
They're the
company
head...
that run it, yeah.
Yeah, what are they, the network or whatever it's called, podcast?
Yeah, Wondery from, no, LA Times from Wondery.
From Wondery.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So, like, not all Wondery ones are LA Times, but they are those. Yeah, yeah,
no,
exactly.
No. So,
yeah.
This is a Wondery. Wondery also produce some, like, really, really good, high-quality
podcasts.
They do.
Podcasts, don't they do,
so
yeah.
That shows you, like, the level that Detective Trap's at, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Anaheim Police Detective Julissa Trap, 37 years old. Basically, all you need to know is she's a badass bitch. She is so interesting throughout this whole story. And there's so many, like, details about her. There's this one bit that I really liked where they're saying she developed some nicknames over the time from being in the police force and then being a detective. So one of her nicknames was Hurricane Julie, which referred to the force she became in the thick of a case. And she was also nicknamed the Cape because she flapped around like one, trying to hang on to the neck of a suspect twice her size who objected to his arrest.
Oh, I love it.
So I think that was kind of like set the scene of what she is really like. And the podcast really does go back into her sort of story and how she gets started and stuff. But for the sake of time, we're going to have to skip right through. So this story actually starts before Trapp is even aware, and women begin disappearing in the Santa Ana area in fall of 2013. Most of them, if not all of them, were sex workers. So as we all know, unfortunately, a lot of it went unnoticed, and they weren't necessarily connected because there was no reason to believe that they would be connected. It's sex workers who had gone missing. So we have Kanaya Jackson disappeared on October 6th. She had just turned 20. About 18 days after she went missing, Josephine Mononique Vargas went missing. She was 34. 20 days after Vargas's disappearance and 37 days after Jackson, we have Martha Anaya. She goes disappearing. She goes missing, or you could say she disappeared. She was 27, a local woman with two daughters. So this is all sort of fall 2013. We jump forward to March 2014, and Detective Trapp is sent to a Republic Waste Services, basically like a giant dump, where they believe they find a young woman's body. And unfortunately, there is a woman in the pile of trash. And so as you can imagine, like, the worst possible crime scene location, because she had all these injuries, but was that caused how she died, or was that caused in getting her there? And there's just garbage literally everywhere. So basically they decide, okay, we need to just collect trash about 30 feet in every direction of this body, because we have no idea if any of it's useful, which I can't even imagine. The main idea is that they are looking for addresses that were in the trash where she might have been disposed of. So like receipts and really minute things like that, which is insane. So at this point, Trapp's partner, Lynn, sees something. He finds a tube of acrylic sealant labeled Tremglaze. It is the only thing that has a hard surface sort of in her area. So the only thing that could have a clean fingerprint. So on the basis of that, it's kind of near her, and it's kind of a hard surface. He decides that he's going to bag it, and they're going to see if they can get prints, which, number one reason why I could never be a police officer, because I would not think of that. Like, oh my God. When Anaheim police stop suspects, they record all their tattoos and, like, identifiable body... God, I don't want to say body... I want to say body bits. That's not what I want to say. Identification, whatever. You know what I'm trying... Okay, anyway.
We know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying. They quickly identify the victim as Janae Estep, 21. Probably didn't pronounce that right. I'm very sorry. The only reason they had that information was because they had actually detained her a year before on suspicion of prostitution, and she had a tattoo on her neck, so she was able to be identified that way. At this point, they sort of talk about, they hadn't really ruled out the possibility of some sort of connection between Estep's death and the disappearance of the other three women, because they had all been working as sex workers. They had all kind of been in a similar area. The likelihood that it was going to be somebody who knew each victim, right? Like, that's, we know from watching all of our true crime shows that it's primarily somebody who knows the victim. So the likelihood it was a serial killer is just statistically unlikely. What blew my mind, that acrylic sealant. So they get it examined, and the detective's hunch has been right. It does have a fingerprint. And what more, the fingerprint matched a local man whose prints were actually on file. So this whole case is full of, like, police work and detective work that I... Like, it just blows my mind, the level that you think you find a body in a dump and that's it. Like, that's a dead end. But yeah, the fact that they're able to, like, piece all these things together is insane. So the guy they find the print to, he's a window installer. So they go to his mobile home park, and he lives, I guess, near the area in Santa Ana. It's all very connected. So he says, yes, they use those types of tubes, and the body was actually wrapped in this type of tarp. And he confirms that that is the tarp that they use on jobs. So now they're getting, like, the fact that that fingerprint actually is connected to the case as well is unbelievable. And what's super eerie is while they're canvassing the area, Detective Trapp learned that a man was living in this old Lindy camper on site. And one of the business owners actually said, like, he's kind of creepy. And the camper worked for Boss Paint and Body, which is, like, just a narrow alley away from these window guys. And she sees him, and he's just, like, a boring-looking white guy. They say he's just, you know, a bland-looking guy in glasses, medium height. And he is watching them as well, but he's just, he's not really part of the equation at this point. They also decide, why don't we check the court-ordered GPS ankle bracelets of parolees on sort of around this area at the time that the woman disappeared, just to see if, like, there's any hits. So they kind of had an idea of where the body was dumped because they used that sort of tarp. So they're able to link this body to a certain location, and they run in the system to see if anybody had been around there. Detective Trapp had worked in sex crimes before, so she knew all these people and was like, hey, I need you to run this on the very slim chance that something actually comes from it. And it turns out there are 10 known sex offenders in that area. And there were another 23 in the industrial area where her body was dumped. So between where she normally worked and where she was dumped, there was a handful of people. But there's only one person at both spots, and his name was Frank Cano. So the sex crimes detectives were actually familiar with this guy because he spent a lot of time with another sex offender, Stephen Gordon. So Gordon was 45. He was an auto detailer at Boss Paint. He would have easy access to that shop's trash bin where the body was dumped. She pulls up Gordon's photo, and it's that weird white guy from the Lindy camper. And at this point, the story, like, it's so bonkers. And I don't want to go any further than that. But it's just the fact that they were able to piece so many little bits of information and clues together to wind up with Cano and Gordon, two sex offenders that both have GPS ankle monitors and both were in, like, those locations of the missing people. And how Trapp and her partner piece that stuff together is just, like, the story is bonkers.
And she can really see, like, the needles in the haystack, can't she?
That's what I mean. Like, when I was listening to it, I'm just like, there's no way.
Yeah.
She's definitely an exceptional detective. Like, absolutely. Yeah. She was, like, meant to do this job. And that is the whole, I think, difference with this podcast is it was really interesting. I haven't listened to any podcast where we actually have the detective from the case walking us through it, telling us about how, you know, got to this step from that step. It was just such an interesting perspective. And I think that is what really made it so, so good. And obviously we did get some later access to, like, the tapes and stuff and people, the conversation, you know, it was so interesting.
Yeah, because I think, Anna, this was one that you recommended. And I was at the gym and I was like, all right, Anna's recommended a new podcast. I have to give it a shot.
Thanks, Elena.
And I listened to it too, bitch.
I'm kidding.
I got like two or three episodes into it. And then all of a sudden it clicked that I had actually watched this story before from a Dateline episode.
Oh.
But because there's such a focus on the detectives and the evidence collecting and stuff, the Dateline usually kind of glosses over because, like, not enough time. But I had actually heard the story, and I just knew the basic bits of sort of how it finished. But it was so interesting to see, like, what actually took place and how they collected the evidence and how they pieced it together. And it does talk a lot about Detective Trapp interrogates the suspects herself, and some of the audio, like you said, you can listen to. And the way she has to sort of talk to these men is just unbelievable.
It is. You can, she definitely, as well, like, the victims in her cases, she's like, she just gives her whole life to this job and to the victims and being with the, and hearing her talk about, you know, having to talk to all the mothers of the victims and just the, and it was just, I don't know, I was getting a little bit, the last episode, it's almost getting a little choked up, just how she has, how much she genuinely just cares for these people and fights for them.
Yeah, she'd put, like, pictures of of the victims up on her desk, so they're always there, always watching, and like she can always see them, so she knows what she's working towards. Mm. I really can't imagine that like many detectives would do that.
No, and she was even saying, I think she gets rosary beads for each mother. So when like she solves that case, she then gives the beads and stuff to the mother, and it's just like, oh Lord, I'm gonna cry on this treadmill. It's coming.
I know. I was doing lunges and I was like, I gotta stop. Like, oh, yeah. It was really good. It was totally a different view than I think we're used to listening to. A lot of time we just get the journalist's side of it rather than like or the narrator or whatever, you know, rather than the actual, you know, person. It's great.
Yeah, and it was very like focused on the victims and the victims' families. And that's why it took me so long to actually recognize the case, because obviously Dateline has to glaze over that stuff. So you don't really learn about the people impacted. Whereas in this podcast, it really goes into the families and who they were and all that kind of stuff. So I thought it was really great. What kind of rating would you guys give it out of 5?
I'd probably give it a 5. I thought it was great. I loved it. It was B... I don't know. Yeah, or maybe like a 4.85. I don't know. It's up there. It's
really specific, wasn't it? 4.85.
Yeah. I don't know. It was just a really good listen. I just think anyone who's into true crime will probably find it interesting, at least. At the least, it's an interesting story.
Yeah, definitely like 4.5. It gives a really good, different perspective, because you also learn a lot about Julissa Trapp herself as well, which is really interesting. Yeah, really good.
Yeah, I think I'm gonna go for the full 5. I really enjoyed it. Definitely a different perspective. You learn way more about what it takes to actually put a case like this together. And yeah, fabulous. Definitely check it out if you're interested.
So the next thing that we will chat about today is the new Netflix true crime documentary, Don't Fuck with Cats, Hunting an Internet Killer. Have you guys watched it?
Yes. I binged it all in one go. Sorry, I don't know who's supposed to go first. just put in more of those cricket noises.
I know, can you put some more cricket noises in?
We're not like being rude. We just don't know who wants to talk first. She's Canadian, I'm British. We're just really fucking polite, okay?
I know, you're like, it's a polite off. Like, who's going to talk first?
A polite off.
All right.
I haven't watched this one. I ended up watching The Confession Killer instead, which we will probably talk at another point. But I do kind of know the story, and I'm pretty sure this is the Canadian guy.
Yes.
Psycho. Yes.
So before I watched it, I had heard I saw what it was kind of loosely, who it was about. And I knew about him just, I think probably from other podcasts. Like maybe My Favorite Murder talked about him. And also, I'm surprised I don't remember him from actually it being in the... Because it wasn't even that long ago, was it? It was only
pretty recent.
It was fairly recent, all of it, to be honest. But I had no idea. And I think you should still... We're gonna talk to you about it, but I definitely recommend you go back and watch it at some point because it's very good. All right, so the series tells the story of one of Canada's most infamous crimes, the murder of Lynn June. The first episode begins with us being introduced to Deanna Thompson, a.k.a. Bowdy Movin, and John Green, who are two, for lack of a better word, internet nerds. They kind of say that they are. And they kind of narrate us through the story and, like, you know, we hear it from that perspective. And I have to go back and say, Bowdy Movin is B-A-U-D-I space M-O-O-V-A-N. So that's her online alias. And it's from the Beastie Boys song. Body Movin', which I've now had stuck in my head ever since I've watched the show.
Yeah, I had to like put it on my phone just so I can hear the song. It was so stupid.
Yeah, but I loved it. I actually thought it was quite clever. So that's kind of, she does reveal her actual name as well, her, you know, which is Deanna Thompson. John Green, the other one, that is just a pseudonym? What is that word?
Pseudonym.
Yeah. Okay, there we go. In 2010, a video was posted on the internet of two kittens being killed by a man whose face is not shown on camera. The video went viral due to the outrage, obviously, and that is when the two narrators of our story join a Facebook group of other internet sleuths who aim to track down the kitten killer. Now, I know that they didn't actually show the video, but I still hid my face under the blanket every time. Because
they showed like clips from it.
Did they?
And they weren't the worst parts of the video, but there are no good parts of the video.
No, it's horrific. Yeah.
And that's of all of the videos.
Yeah. It's bad. It's not good. It's very, very bad. And so it starts out, and they just, it circulates around about how horrific, and they want to track this down because obviously, as we know, from even from last week's episode for the McDonald triad, whether it's true or not, one of the key points, which most people probably still think is true, is cruelty to animals. So I think it was alarm bells for some people in that they were like, wait, whoa. Like if somebody's doing this, who knows what else he's up to?
Yeah, and I think like escalation is a big deal.
Hmm.
So I don't know if we can link it like directly to the McDonald triad, but it's still like alarm bells. You're right, 100%.
Yeah, well, I just, like I said, you know, like last week, how Eliana and I both kind of thought that was like standard for, yeah, so everyone, you see that and you're like, whoa. Also, it's just horrible, and of course. So over the next 2 years, the pair, along with others, take apart the video bit by bit, looking for clues. During this time, though, the suspected kitten killer infiltrates the group and starts to sort of taunt the sleuths a bit. He posts two further videos of him harming other cats. They're pretty awful. They're really awful. Oh, and again, I would hide under, I don't really know exactly what happened in them because I just couldn't, it was just awful. And they don't, I don't believe if you're squeamish, they don't actually show the whole video or anything.
I think you can Google and they will, someone put on something like the timestamps for the more graphic part. So you can use that to skip over.
Yeah. Cause I know you and I, Hannah, obviously we are definite cat ladies. And
crazy
we,
cat ladies.
Yeah. It's definite crazy cat lady. 100%. It's fine. Mm. I'm proud.
I am who I am.
Yeah, exactly. So we were kind of chatting before because we're a bit like squeamish maybe about, we're unsure about watching it.
I'm a dog lover, so I'm perfectly okay watching this.
Not that you want to see kittens getting hurt.
Cats are nothing to me.
Oh, it was, yeah. Yeah, it was hard. But, you know, obviously I'm glad that a lot of the kitten things sort of are mainly focused in the first episode. So we kind of move past it, obviously, because his behavior escalates. As they thought it would. Now, the group successfully identify the kitten killer as Luca Magnotta. Magnotta is a Canadian citizen. He spent his younger years attempting to become a model actor. He ended up working as a sex worker to make money when his acting career sort of didn't take off. And they sort of discovered that he posted hundreds of pictures and websites all over the internet about himself and started rumors about himself. And it is just really apparent that he's very like self-obsessed, obsessed about fame, literally no matter what the cost. Now, I am skipping over a lot of like really interesting and more details, but literally just go and watch the, even if you're listening to our review, I'm not spoiling anything. It's still incredible what these people are able to, you know, track down. Just stuff like they would, going back to the first video, they took stills of like the entire room and were like trying to figure out what country was in by looking at like the still of the plug socket or the blanket that was on the bed and trying to find, because it was very
unique.
Yeah, and
the Hoover and things like that.
The Hoover.
And like the cigarettes. And it's like, what the fuck?
It was incredible. And then just how they were able to actually like, you know, find him. And wow, I'm impressed. And yeah, they're definitely my heroes. They track Magnotta to Toronto, where they are able to locate what they believe is his address. They report him to the police there, and an officer does a check on the address only to find that Magnotta has moved on. Now, did you notice this as well, Hannah? Did you notice that his last name was pronounced about 8 different ways throughout the whole... the whole of the
yeah
film.
I mean, as someone whose surname is pronounced 18 different fucking ways, I feel it.
You got it. You were like, I feel
my
it.
Boss pronounces my surname incorrectly and I don't have the heart to correct her.
It's gone too far now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's too deep. Yeah no, you're right, there were a lot of different pronunciations of
yeah,
his surname.
How would you say it as a Canadian?
I always thought it was Luca Magnotta.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But like the there's an eventual, which I'll get to her, but like a police detective, but she's French. She must be, yeah, she's French.
French-Canadian?
French-Canadian. Mm. She pronounces it differently too.
Oh, they pronounce everything wrong.
Okay.
Just alienate half a country.
Bit like the British, but that's okay. I mean, anyway. Part of the thing was that they wanted to find out what jurisdiction, what country and everything that he was in, mainly because they want to be able to report to the authorities, because obviously the escalation factor and when they do that, unfortunately, it ends up being a dead end, but they did see it coming. In 2012, another video is uploaded online. This time it is the brutal murder of a male who was later identified as Lin Jun, a student from China. Thompson and Green desperately try to notify the officer in Toronto, but are unsuccessful. So this gets posted online and you don't see his face. And again, they don't show the whole video on the documentary either. So they do show.
No, they show really, really small clips of that one, don't they?
Yeah.
Like really, really like almost like not even a couple of seconds.
No. And
which is good, obviously.
Yeah. So he essentially sort of tell you what is going on in the video, and that is there is a male and he's blindfolded and he's tied up and he's on a bed, but you can see like a poster behind him, and that's kind of like they kind of show the first like frame of it, and he is then attacked. I believe then a dog is killed as well, isn't it? A puppy is then killed in the video. It's awful.
I do remember kind of when this was sort of happening that people thought that video was fake. And so people were actively watching it and not realizing like, wow, I've just given myself PTSD. Like this is an actual thing that's just happened.
Oof. Yeah, it's awful. I think he does eventually decapitate the victim, and then they don't show us any of these bits of the video, thank God. But it is shown of where his head is in like the bathtub, and that's how they actually are able to sort of help identify the victim at first, I think, because we do get an interview from the victim's best friend. And he was
so sweet, wasn't he?
I know, it was so heartbreaking.
I just felt like my heart broke when he came on the screen and was like talking about who he was as a person, and I was just like
Yeah. Oh, it was awful, because this was just horrific. So this is when the police come into the story, and they start to give their interviews and narrate the police investigation. Sort of, we still have the hearing from our two like internet sleuths as well, but obviously this is when it takes off for the police. Meanwhile, in Montreal, a suitcase is found behind an apartment building by a caretaker, and he sees like flies and stuff coming out of it, and so he opens it and finds a torso. Obviously, the police are called, and it's all cordoned off, and they start to gather all the evidence, like, around the scene, and that they actually find the dog, they find some clothes, and they find some ID with Magnata's name on it. So it kind of, it's in this, like, a separate area, but it's right around all of it. And that's sort of when they are become aware of him. And then they are obviously made aware of the video, so it's all kind of, like, coming together. So an international manhunt is launched when they discover Magnata has then gone on the run to Paris. So they track him to the airport. He flies to Paris. We see some police officers in Paris who are trying to find him. They're like just missing him. It's like a proper, something. It's all a big movie plot. It's all pans out. Like it could very easily just be this, you know, a movie that you'd watch.
Yeah, they liken it to Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, Catch Me If You Can. Exactly. Then he goes to Berlin, where he is eventually apprehended in an internet cafe looking at information about himself. Obviously, he's literally posted all over the whole world, like news. So international news, that's why the gentleman that works at the internet cafe, we hear from him. And he, you know, he said he was just looking at some news articles about him. And he looks up and he's standing there. Yeah, so he was quite clever too, because what he did was he set him up, and he set him up on purpose somewhere that he could go and see what he was looking at, because he wasn't sure. He wanted to get another look. So then he pretended to take the trash and like he was getting trash and sweeping up, whatever. And he kind of looked up to see what he was looking at, and he was obviously looking at stuff about himself, and he kind of realized, yeah, I know this is the guy, definitely. I was like, that is good. And then he called the police and they came and apprehended him.
There's a great CCTV footage of that, isn't there? Where like all of the German guard come in. It's like, oh, it's perfect. It's so good.
So he is extradited back to Canada. And actually, I thought that was interesting, but no airlines would take him back. So they actually had to get the Canadian military to fly a plane over and bring him back, because they were like, no, he's definitely coming back to stand trial for this. Yeah, and so that's kind of that's where our story sort of ends, and they do obviously sort of let us know later on that he stands trial and is convicted and is currently in prison. But yeah, that is the basic story. I have left out quite a lot, so I recommend, even if you've listened to this, it's worth watching because it is just a very fascinating story. At the end, which I thought was great, I don't know whatever kind of mental illness Magnata has. It's obviously, you could see he's got this like extreme narcissism. He was with it. He was smart because he was leaving clues and breadcrumbs. It was like a movie, what he was doing with the people on the internet and even with the police at the end, what he was doing with that. It's like he had set up all this for years before that. Mm. Like he knew exactly what he was going to do. And they said that he had been obsessed with the film Basic Instinct. If you watch, they were able to sort of show all these different things that he did that kind of line up with the plot of the movie.
Jeez.
And like it was even to the point of like when he was in an interview asking for a cigarette and crossing his legs. Like,
yeah,
it was wild.
I think for him as well, too, it was very much not necessarily, I don't even think he wanted to get away with it. I think it was, how can I make the biggest splash? How can I taunt people? And how can I, like, leave these breadcrumbs? And then if I get caught, you know, I'm assuming that I will, but then I'll have this big trial and I'll be, like, I'll be infamous, right? Because he couldn't be an actor, he couldn't be a model, but at least he could be famous in Canadian history.
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there. That's exactly what it was. It was all planned out. Like, it was pretty, like, you know, he was always going to get caught, I think, too. I think he wanted to get caught eventually.
Yeah,
he
definitely
liked the chase, but yeah. So we do hear from his mother, which I do feel like she was just in denial completely.
Yeah. But even she had, like a box of, like, keepsakes of his, and even in there was a key ring, and it had, like, a little Basic Instinct movie poster on it, on the key ring. Oh, and she was just like, oh, he was just so obsessed with this film growing up, and it's like, oh, what's happening in real life? It's, oh.
Yeah, it was, they also, what his defense, he was trying to say that he when he was a sex worker, he'd been sort of controlled by someone named Manny, and made to do all these things that he didn't want to, kidnapped and beaten up and bullied and all these things. Obviously, there's never been any actual proof of Manny existing, but it was like a background he had like made for years. Even you really have to watch it. It was wild, and the fact I think at the end his mom's like, no, you should be looking for Manny. It was him. He made him do it, and he was there. He had to do it. But then they discover that Manny, if you look at Basic Instinct, I don't know if you guys know the premise of the story. Have you ever watched Basic? I haven't watched it in years.
I have, yeah.
And Sharon Stone, like, abusive ex-boyfriend, his name was, like, Manny. So they were
That's where that comes from.
But I have to say, when I started watching it, I had to, like, force myself to go to sleep because it was very fascinating. And it's a horrible story. And I do feel guilty that he is now getting more fame. Mm. This is what he wants. You know, I almost wish they hadn't made this because this is probably just fueling the fire that he always wanted. But it was very well made, in my opinion.
What would you guys rate it out of 5?
Oh, 5.
Yeah, 5, hands down.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was
if
definitely...
not higher, yeah.
Yeah, if I could go higher, it was like...
like 10.
Yeah, I have to say it's one of the best true crime documentaries I've ever seen.
Yeah, damn. And it's only in, like, 3 parts.
Yeah.
It's, like, 3-ish, maybe just over 3 hours. Really good, really good. Also, if, like, I ever go missing, get Body Moving.
Oh, she is.
Get Deanna Thompson in. She's going to be like, I know that plug socket, and he's got that Hoover.
She's a badass.
She was so cool. She's just
so cool.
Brilliant.
I hope, like, they should literally hire her as, like, a, you know, as part of a... the police force, just to do like what she was doing on the internet, like the stuff they were hunting down and the stuff they were putting together. It was just amazing. It was so good, the fact that it was such a cool perspective. I know that really, like, the people on the internet's loose, they didn't necessarily solve the case because he kind of led the police there too.
Mm.
But they had it figured out before the police did, and they were trying to tell the police. But it was such an interesting perspective. I've never seen, you know, the way it was told is kind of, you know, just like Detective Trapp, that was another perspective that we don't see often. This was just so well done. It wasn't your typical true crime documentary where you just get interviews from like the police and then the defense attorney kind of, you know?
Yeah.
So fabulous.
Weird crime time.
So we've talked about rapists, we've talked about murderers, we've talked about people killing animals. So we're going to lighten the mood with a nice weird crime time. So this is from an article in New York Times. We'll put the link and everything on our website, as with all the sources from this episode. We're going to go to Las Vegas for this one. On the 5th of December, a gentleman named Bobby Lee posted a 12-second video to his Facebook page that goes viral. The subject of the video is pigeons, and those pigeons are doing everyday pigeon things, pecking around, being pigeons. But these pigeons had a little something special going on. These pigeons were wearing tiny cowboy hats.
Amazing.
One had a little red one on, and one had a little grey one on. And you can, if we'll post a link to the video. I think it's on the New York Times website. But he's just so ecstatic about it, and he's like, "The birds have hats, bro!" And it's so like joyful.
Wholesome it's, content.
It's so wholesome. It's absolutely brilliant. So some people suspected that the cowboy hat wearing pigeons were connected to the Wrangler National Finals rodeo that was in town, but they denied all involvement. There were more sightings of the pigeons. There was an unverified report of a pigeon in Reno also, and I wrote, similarly attired. the Las Vegas police noted it didn't appear to be a police matter at this time. The article's actually quite long and it's actually really good. I suggest you go and read the whole thing, but it talks to an ornithologist, so a bird specialist, but he specifically is a pigeon specialist, and he's called Dr. Charles Walcott, and he's from Cornell University. He said, "They seemed to be happy little pigeons. They weren't being affected by the hats in any way, as they seemed light and they weren't affecting their eyesight." So it looks like that the hats are glued on.
Oh, geez.
I know.
Yeah, because I was like, yeah. A bird rescue organization in Las Vegas said that if the hats are glued on, they'd molt off in no time, leaving no lasting damage to the pigeon. But it raised just like so many questions for me. And I was thinking about this a lot because I was just like, who did it? Why did they do it? I mean, obviously, because it's hilarious. How did they do it? Are the hats tied on? Or are they glued on? Because I can imagine like a little
little strap
underneath. That'd be really cute. Where did the tiny hats come from? Like, were the hats homemade? Did someone sit at home making tiny cowboy hats for pigeons? It's just great. It brought me so much joy.
I remember seeing the picture. I think it was on Twitter, and it had two of them with the little hats on, and I snorted so goddamn hard. It's like, I've never seen anything more beautiful in my entire life. And yeah, somebody made those by hand, 100%.
Definitely. So I think that the cowboy hat is the perfect hat for a pigeon because they've got like a jaunty little walk.
I was just thinking in my head, I was
like your funky little dinosaur, like go for it. But it really got me thinking, what hat would you put on other birds? So I was thinking like a robin in a top hat.
Of course.
Would be exquisite. So I'd really like to know people's like bird hat combos.
Bird hat combos.
I know in Ontario we have a lot of blue jays, and while they are very pretty to look at, they are the biggest bitches. They're like really bad bullies, and they like attack other birds and stuff. So I can picture like a blue jay with a baseball hat on, but backwards, like one of those types of
What
about like I was thinking like a magpie, maybe like one of those Peaky Blinders hats.
Yeah, flat cap.
Like a flat cap, yeah.
We have a lot of magpies where we live, and they're so noisy, and they like jump all over the roof and all over the kitchen roof, and the cats just go like insane for them. And they're like, they really try and like razz the cats. They're like flapping the windows and then flap away and then like come back just because the cats just like smashing themselves against the window.
That's amazing. They taunt them.
Yeah, they're great. So yeah, I can imagine like a magpie and little flat cap, that'd be hilarious.
Flat cap.
I'd really like to hear other people, so all the listeners, tell us your bird hat combos.
And we'll, what is your...
Yeah.
Definitely.
We'll put some favourites on our Instagram or something, that'd be cool. Pigeons. Pigeons and cowboy hats.
what more could you ask for?
Exactly.
So I think that's all we have for today. Please check out our website, murderfriends.com. where you can get some extra content or check out our sources or the articles we've chatted about today. Send us an email, murderfriendspod@gmail.com. Let us know what your birds with hats would be. We want to know. Follow us on Instagram, murderfriendspod, and Twitter, murderfriendspd. And I think we'll talk to you later.
Bye.